that was one of the things growing up, like I did in West Africa. One of the things I learned was that West Africans, and most Africans can do this, they can sleep anywhere, anytime, in any position. And they really can. They'd be in these buses, this is called money buses, that ran up and down the road taking them places. You'd see them all stacked in there, and they'd be next to each other, shoulder to shoulder. They'd be, if you ever looked in one, half of them would be asleep, snoring, and they're sitting upright. And I'm like, I don't know how they do that. That is absolutely amazing to me. Crazy. All right. It's close to starting time. I've got about 2 minutes here. By the time I pass out your little pages here, I think we'll be ready to get on with this. We are looking at the last two books tonight, and both of them are rather short. This is the last class for the Old Testament. We jump to the New Testament on the next gathering, which I believe Terry will do a couple of those Wednesdays, and then I'll be back with you. So he and I are just trading off now. So you only get one sheet tonight. I don't have an outline. You'll just have to forgive me. I didn't get to that today. Explained this to you earlier. I'm an incredibly lazy person. And I was back at school with a bunch of 8th grade hooligans that had been on spring break, so you can imagine how that went. Oh my gosh. Yeah, they got FSA stuff. Need one? Sharon? She lets you look on? That's so sweet. Man, that's really nice. But yeah, they're getting ready. The 6th graders are starting off at our school tomorrow testing, and then next week will be the rest of them. So be just such fun. And of course, administering those are such fun because we get to sit in there with them for hour upon hour, and we can't do anything. We have to watch them while they do their tests. You know what? It just don't get better than that, I don't think. So anyway. All right. Well, we are, like I said, we're into our last couple of Old Testament books here. The books of Zechariah, and as Ryan Raymond calls it, the great Italian prophet Malachi. It's Malachi, but I don't think I'd ever heard it that way, and I thought that was great. So I'm going to steal that and use that from now on. Yes, the great Italian prophet Malachi. So I just thought that was awesome. I mean, that's something I would think of. It really is. I was like, man, why didn't I ever think of that? You know, yeah, it really does. That's what it looks like. I had a seminary buddy. He loved the prophet Amos, and I asked him, "Why are you so crazy about Amos?" He said, "Cause he was a redneck." I said, "What?" He said, "Go read the first part of Amos." So I go back and read, and it does. It describes Amos as being from the south, and he grew fig trees. So he was a redneck who had a farm. And I was like, you know, you're really stretching it there, Bubba, but that's why he liked Amos. So anyway, as always, we want to get started though with a word of prayer and any of those things that we need to be concerned about. As always, just continue to remember the very world we live in and the challenges we face every day, I tell you, and all that goes on and happens. Do remember, if you will, please remember Janice. My wife, she is in a lot of pain. She hurt her ribs real bad when she had the wreck in one of my Broncos a while back, and she landed over on the she flipped and rolled it, and she landed up on the driver's door, and she hit the armrest there, and I think she really cracked a couple of ribs, bruised herself up real bad. She never really has gotten over that. You just kind of, being a kindergarten teacher, you're always moving, picking up kids, you know, doing these kind of things. And so she never really got over it. Well, she hurt it again. And while we were on our little couple of days over at St. Augustine this week, she re-injured it. And she is in a tremendous amount of pain. And I'm going to get with your hand that anyone who decides to make it. And she's in a lot of pain. In fact, she can't even put her hand on it. It hurts so bad right here. And she touches it and she screams. She finally went today. He just said, look, he said, it's just a re-aggravation of the old injury. And he said, sometimes those rib injuries will take up 6 months to heal. said, so all I can do for you is give you some steroids, cut the inflammation down, and give you some painkillers at night for at night, some muscle relaxers, try to loosen that stuff up where you can function. So hopefully she can get some rest tonight. That's what she needs more than anything. She's just not able to sleep because she can't move, and she moves. So it's kind of ridiculous right now. See, I remember her. I know she's hurt real bad. I was having to find shoes this morning and get them on the feet, dressing her. And I didn't sign up to be a butler, but I was this morning. So. Of course, it's the best in our world. It's the best in our world, though, because with our bedroom, the mess it is, she's like coming out, she's got one flip-flop on going, can you find the other flip-flop like this? It's in there somewhere. I'm going, I got to leave in 30 minutes. I don't have enough time, But I found that other flip-flop I got. I was proud of myself. I don't know. Yeah. There were some other scary things I found, too, but I'm going to talk about that. So. I did. I found Jimmy Hoffa. He was right there. Yeah, just what was left. But anyway, y'all remember her, please. Keep her in your prayers. I had mentioned my dad, I think, a while back. He had his knee replacement surgery not too long ago. He's doing great. We got to go up and see him during spring break. And while I was there, he graduated from his walker to his cane to walking around the house without any help. So he's doing really, really well. He's a go-getter. He doesn't like... He was so funny. He's 87 years old. Mom's 87. He's 87. And he was sitting there one day, and he's just been real funny with this one. It's just really gotten to him because he just finally said to Mom, he said the other day, he said, Betty, he said, I don't remember being this bored with the other knees. I said, is that your problem, Dad? Are you just bored? He said, I am. He said, I'm bored to death. He said, I can't do anything fully. He said, but I can do some things. I said, well, he'll get there. Hang on. So I said, well, that's your biggest problem. We'll go with that. Anybody else we should remember tonight? Anybody we need to confess? All right, your daughter's doing your day. All right. Oh, no. I'm sorry to hear that. Sorry. Huh? Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Okay, so Scott's dad. Yes, sir. Definitely kicking you. Yeah, that will. You won't do that again, will she? Alright, definitely. Yeah, that's the favorite stuff too. Alright then. Well, let's have a word of prayer and we'll dive into our couple of books here and see what we can learn tonight. Heavenly Fathers, we do gather here. We thank you again for the chance to be in this place. We thank you again for the hard work that's gone into this building that you've blessed us with. Thank you for the way things look now, the new look of the stage, and all those who have given their time and talent and just their sweat and I'm sure some blood here and there, scraped knuckles and busted thumbs. We thank you, God, for all that they have done. We ask, God, that you would help us to use it to glorify and bless your name. Father, as we gather here tonight, we thank you, and I thank you for everyone that's here. I pray that you're just going to be with them tonight and be with me as we go through this time. Pray for your Holy Spirit to be in complete control and open our hearts and minds to what it is you would have us to take away from here tonight as we look at these two books. Pray that you be with Terry as he's out and about and on the road tonight, and just bless him, keep him safe. And God, for those that have been mentioned, for those that need your healing hand, for those who need a comforting hand at this time, lost loved ones, those who are just going through difficult and challenging times, just spiritually and emotionally and all that goes with that, we pray, God, for your hand to be present there also. Lord, again, we just thank you for your grace and your mercy as part of our lives every day. And God, sometimes we don't take a moment to recognize that when we should. So God, help us to do that and help us to live our lives so that others can see your grace and your mercy active in our lives. Thank you now. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. All right. Right. Well, as I said, tonight we're kind of wrapping up here. We're down to our last couple of minor prophets in the Old Testament, last two books in the Old Testament, and then we'll jump on into the New Testament. Believe it or not, we are getting close to the end of this. We're winding through. It's like today I was with my kids as they all came back from spring break, and we were trying to get in routine again, and I was especially talking to my first period class, and we had gone through and looked at their grades, and you know, some of them had some stuff that they needed to really make sure they took care of because they weren't. And so I said, you know, I said, well, the guys think about it this. I said, you know, we're running out of days here. I said, it's winding down. So I said, you're going to need to get on it because before you know it, we're going to be done. And that's kind of like this. I think we're going to, before we know it, we're going to be through. So hopefully we can. Would you believe I underestimated? You guys actually just came out here in mass tonight and threw me off. So, you know, see, that's me. I'm being pessimistic. Shame on me. I'll have to owe you. I'll try to get some and leave them on the table somewhere. So, tonight we're looking at the books of Zechariah and Malachi. And so we're going to jump in here with Zechariah and get started with him and look at a little bit about him and who he was and what God was doing with him and how he was being used. I know the screen's a little bit smaller looking because they kind of rearranged some stuff and made it a little bit smaller that way, so bear with me. Use your sheet there in front of you. You'll see that better than this. But when we talk about Zechariah, one of the things that most folks attribute, again, the authorship of the book Zechariah to Zechariah, and he was a priest. So he was one of these guys that had a dual role in Israel. He was a priest and a prophet. Because let's understand, not all the prophets were priests and not all the priests were prophets. So it wasn't a normal, necessary thing. It did happen. But in this case, he was both. Most likely, he was of a priestly line, so he most likely was a priest, but he also was a prophet in the sense that he was chosen to speak specific certain words to Israel about things that were going to happen, things that were happening, and what they needed to do and how they needed to be. So that is kind of a unique combination. Not all of the prophets went that way. You know, it's funny. Titles are interesting things, and you know, we all have them in different things that we do in jobs and in our lives. And I remember I had not been ordained very long as a minister, and it was my first little church in Central Georgia, and we had wiener dogs. We had two wiener dogs, Lucy and Desi, and they were just great wiener dogs. Yeah, it was. And Desi, one Sunday morning before church, Desi had a stroke of some sort. He had a seizure and a stroke kind of thing happened to him, and I desperately called some of the men in the church that I knew would probably know somebody and said, hey, I need to find a vet this morning. Something's happened to our dog. And they called, of course. It was a really small town, very small town. They called and got a hold of the vet. He said, meet me at my office. You know where it is. I said, yes, I do. We got there, and so he got in, and he was trying to prep some things. So I was sitting in the office area with Desi, and he came out, and they had told him who I was. They said, this is our new pastor at our church. And so he comes out, and he goes, Reverend Carpenter. I didn't respond. That's not a name I knew. I'd never been called that. And that was my dad. You know, my dad was Reverend Carpenter. So I'm just sitting there oblivious to this. I'm going, oh, wait a minute, that's me. Hold on. I'm the only one in this waiting room right now. It's 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. Yeah, that's me. So, you know, we have these titles and that go with us. And in this case, Zechariah had this title of being the priest and the prophet, which was a pretty cool combination. One of the things that's really neat about the combination, and let me kind of point this out to you, I think that we need to understand this. Being a priest and being the prophet, as a priest, his function and his calling and his purpose was to bring the people to a point of worship, okay, of God. And he was there to make the sacrifices on behalf of their sins. He was there to make them very aware and keenly aware of the living presence of a living God. And so he had that side of him that they experienced and saw him do those, they saw him as he did those things. But then there was the prophet side of him, which was then the voice of God, okay, that was given to him to say to the people, this is what God says. So you have one side here that is reminding the people, this is what we do to worship God, and this is how we go about it, and we understand his presence and who he is, and the fact he is a living God and he's with us. And then the other side that says that living God now is saying something directly to you through me, but is saying it to you, this is what you need to be mindful of, okay, and be aware of. So it's kind of a neat combination. His name means Yahweh remembers, which we always do hope that God remembers. God remembers us and remembers our plight. As I said there, a little more information. He was a Levite. Interestingly enough, this is one of the guys who was born in captivity. He was born in Babylon. Okay, he was not born in Judea. He was not born in Israel. He was born in captivity in Babylon, the son of Berechiah and the grandson of Iddo, the priest. Again, one of those names you want to name your children or your grandchildren, right? This is Iddo. He again had this great lineage, and he had this great thing about what he was called to do. Even though he was, as we term him, a minor prophet, he had a very big purpose in what he was sharing. He was a contemporary, meaning he was around at the same time and prophesying at the same time as some of these other folks like Haggai, who we've talked about. He was also around during Zerubbabel's leadership and Joshua the high priest. Zerubbabel. That's hard to say. I think I sprain my lip every time I say that. But he was around at that time. So, again, what I'm trying to get us envisioned there, guys, is that when we talk about, I think here's the way I want to put this. When we look at these minor prophets, and we look at the prophets as we especially get to the end of the Old Testament, you're not looking at a prophet in what I would term a vacuum, okay? In other words, he's not a prophet that's there just by himself. He's typically going to have been a prophet that was either there at the same time that some of the other prophets were, and he was prophesying also, or he closely followed or preceded. I mean, that's, you know, it's just not an in, it's not just one of these incidents just by themselves. Okay, I guess that's what I'm getting at. So we need not think about them in that way. God used, in some cases, several prophets at the same time in different areas to try to get the message across. Okay. That's a great way to do it. You didn't have television, so you didn't have TV ministry and TV evangelists, so you just got lots of guys to do this for you instead. And they were more honest and real anyway. So, now, there is some controversy about this authorship of the entire book of Zechariah being attributed to him. And it's one of those kind of things where people who are way smarter than me, you know, sit around and think about this stuff and look at stuff and come up with these ideas. And they've got some points about what they're saying. It does not mean, and it does not say that what is written here has any less value. That's not the point. The point they're making is that they don't know necessarily that Zechariah wrote the entire book himself. That the other part of it was written by someone, again, that was inspired by God to do so, and it was just included into Zechariah because it was at the same time and about the same thing that was being covered. Some say Zechariah did the whole thing. Here's the reasons why. Let's look at that real quick. Some scholars believe that the last few chapters, 9 through 14, are the ones that Zechariah did not author. In other words, he did not write this. Why do they say that? Well, because these guys are really smart. They go through and they look at certain things to see if a certain style goes through the entire book. Okay, style is an important thing. They look to see if certain keywords are used again and again. For instance, one of the big controversies in the New Testament has always been who authored the book of Hebrews. Who have you always been told authored the book of Hebrews? Anybody think, kind of off the top of their head, who they were told was the author of Hebrews? Huh? Paul, right? That's the typical answer. Now, I will go ahead and take my step out onto the end of the diving board, and I'll tell you, I don't think Paul wrote that book, because there's too many stylistic differences between Paul's other writings and the book of Hebrews. Now, does that make that book any less important or any less inspired of God? No, not at all. I just don't think that he was the author of it. I think there's somebody else that we don't know necessarily who it was. We can guess, but it doesn't change the fact that Hebrews is one of the most powerful books in the New Testament and gets a message across that we need to hear that changes things. So I think, you know, you don't have to get caught up in that. Well, it's the same thing here. This is not something to get caught up in and worry about, but it is something to note. What happens is in chapters 1 through 8, Zechariah mentions his name at least three times. His name is used. Okay, so self-references in those first 8 chapters. In chapters 9 through 14, we don't hear him mentioned again. He doesn't mention himself. He doesn't say his name. His name's not stated. That's a real jump. That's a real change from the beginning of the book to go to where you don't mention your name at all. There are no dates that are mentioned in the last chapters, nor are there any references to historical events in the last chapters, 9 through 14. They are in 1 through 8. We're able to date some of this stuff pretty accurately in chapters 1 through 8 because of what he references. The months, the historical events, and all that's going on, we're able to go, oh, okay, those guys are really smart. You know, they filter it through different calendars and they come out and say, okay, well, that's when that happened. But we're not given that in the last chapters 9 through 14. He doesn't give us any of that. So again, that's where people will question and say, well, did he really write this? Because he kind of went off the reservation here. He didn't do the same thing. So again, don't let it get you hung up on anything and don't let it bother you. I'm not trying to do that. I'm just saying I think it's interesting that we have possibility that somebody else authored part of this, but yet it was put under Zechariah's name. We're giving him the credit for that. Now, the other thing about this book, guys, too, is if you'll notice, and you can see it on your sheet, it is what we call a post-exilic book. Sounds fancy, I know. You can go around and use that term if you want to. Nobody else is going to get it. I'm wearing a post-exilic coat. No, I know. Post-exilic book, chapters 1 through 8, were written approximately 520 to 518 BCE, meaning this was the period of time when they had come back from Babylon and Babylonian captivity. They had returned back to Judea. Okay, back to Jerusalem. The chapters 9 through 14, the best guess on that, and here's again why we don't know if it's necessarily the same author, that they were written a little bit later, around 480 BCE. So, a little bit of time gap between the two. Because again, we can place chapters 1 through 8 really, really easily because of all the stuff he gives us. Those last chapters we can't, and so they have to give their best guess at it, and a lot of the scholars say it was a little bit later, around 480. Key personalities, you got Zechariah, Zerubbabel, there I go again, and Joshua. Okay, these were the key characters that were part of his writing here at this time. Ma'am? Post-exilic, it means after the exile. It means they came back from Babylon at this point. Post meaning after the exile. So it means that he was one of those groups of people that came back. In fact, that Cyrus sent back, king of Persia. Cyrus said, go home. Go home. Now, Zechariah was a young man. We know this much about him. He was not very old when he started all this prophesying. And again, he did it alongside Haggai. We talked about that already. What's interesting about him is the tone that he wrote with. It was one of encouragement. A lot of prophets, when we read their books, what do we get a sense of? What's the tone? What are they, the feeling they give us? Doom. Yeah. A lot of these prophetic things are, they're kind of on the darker side. Doom and gloom, and this is what's going to happen, you people. Yeah, it does, and that's an honest thing. Because you read it, you go, God, wait, this is, you know, you guys are doing this again, and God's going to, you know, stomp you out here in a little bit, and then you're going to start all over. And it does, it gets really kind of gloomy, and you just like, but the thing with Zechariah is, his is one of the actually more positive, uplifting prophetic books. His is a book where he is encouraging the Israelites. Let's also understand again, and let's place this in the bigger time picture here, okay? We're talking about a time period where they have come back. Remember in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, what did they start to do in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah? What were they doing that they were told to do by King of Persia? You might remember, I'm checking to see if you pay attention. What were they told to rebuild? The temple. So they have been ordered to go back. Hey there. They've been reported, they have been ordered by Cyrus, who sent them back, to go back and to rebuild the temple. So they had started that. Now, did they finish that in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah? Did they finish building the temple? No, they did not. They got discouraged because they had all these countries around them that were pressuring them and infiltrating and trying to cause problems. And so eventually they got to the point, they got so discouraged, they just quit and they tended to their own homes. And if you remember from our last time together, we had prophetic words against that. You care for your homes, you care for your own gardens, you care for your own things, and look, you still don't have enough to eat, you don't have enough wine to drink, you don't have enough money to take care of things. Life is really tough. Why don't you turn from those things and let's go back to what God wanted you to do in the first place, which was to rebuild the temple for His glory. And you know what? If you do that, then God's going to take care of those other things. That was what was going on. Well, this is where we're at, kind of on the tail end of this, because now we've got Zechariah here, trying to give some encouraging words to them to say, hey guys, let's go back and let's get on this temple building and let's finish it. Let's do what God wanted us to do. Okay? And so this is kind of where we find ourselves. It is also an interesting book in the sense that it is the one that has the clearest and largest number of messianic messages, meaning prophetic words about the coming Messiah. This one has a bunch of them. This little book of Zechariah, now Minor Prophet, is filled with references to the Messiah and the coming Messiah and who he would be and what he would do and all that he would accomplish. So it is unique in that sense. For being a very small, minor, as we call it, a minor prophet, it has a lot of neat things in it. From the encouragement factor, which face it, we need that. We need that encouragement. It is nice when somebody says something in a positive way to you, that you're doing a good job, or they appreciate you doing this or that. Those are the words we like to hear, you know? And it's funny, even as adults, how much that really gets to us. Don't you love it? When somebody comes, hey, you've been doing a great job. Or if you're one of those that works out there, you know, situation where you're working with the public every day and you do something and somebody recognizes you did something nice and if you did it right, you did it well, and they say, hey, thank you for handling that situation. Because most of the time you get yelled at, right? You get fussed at, you know? And it's just like, you know, good Lord. Right now, and I'm really going to miss this when Leah gets married and finally moves totally out, I'm really going to miss this. Because every evening she comes home from working at CVS and Hawthorne, the stories are just fantastic of the people she's dealt with that day. And she'll tell me stuff, and I'm going, my mind's going, are there really people that stupid on the earth? And she goes, yes, and I deal with them every day. You know, from everything from like the lady coming in saying, I need something to kill pinworms. And my daughter saying to her, ma'am, we don't carry that anymore. Well, what do you have that'll do that? Well, ma'am, we don't carry that anymore. Well, I'll just go look over here. Go right ahead. We don't carry that anymore. The woman came back the next day and went to and called the pharmacist over and said, I need something to kill pinworms. To which the pharmacist said, we don't carry anything like that. Well, I'm just going to look back over here. Go right ahead. You know. But every now and then you get the one where you do something extra for them, you step out, you go out of the way, and they say, hey, really appreciate you doing it. Thank you for making a difference. And that's important. We like that. So this was what's so great about this book, is that there's a lot of stuff in here that says, hey, you're God's people, you're doing a great job, keep doing it, and do what God's calling you to do, okay? And be a part of that, and trust that God's had this great plan. Some refer to this book as the miniature book of Isaiah, because it has so much messianic stuff in it. And that's pretty neat, you know, when it talks about that, this kind of miniature book of Isaiah. One of the things that's really nice in this book of Zechariah is we see him with this vision and this anticipation of a complete and full restoration of God and his people. A full restoration of that relationship. Because again, let's talk about what we've seen so far. We have seen a broken relationship between God and his people. And who's breaking that relationship? The people. Exactly. God's not doing it. The people are. They're the ones making the choices. They're the ones that know exactly what God expects of them. that it's not very hard, and yet they continue to do the opposite of what God expects. And so his book, Zechariah's book, has this nice sense to it that there will come a time, okay, there will come a time where this relationship will be restored fully and completely. Notice, too, that he talks about this restoration is not only for the Jews, but it is for everyone. And again, this is a change in tone, okay, that it's going to be that it's going to be a restoration for all people, not just the Jews. One of the things we do have to say about Zechariah is this, though, and we were talking about sometimes we don't like to read them because of the doom and gloom. Well, I'll tell you the one reason that some people struggle with Zechariah is because he uses a lot of symbolic language. Very interesting words to describe things about the way certain things are, the way that he's envisioning things. When you get into the last part, especially in those last chapters, you're going to see that. Well, actually, you don't have to go that far. Go to chapter 4 here, and let's look at some of the things that he uses in Zechariah chapter 4, some of the ways he talks about some of his visions, and you'll get a sense of what I'm talking about. Says, the angel who was speaking with me returned and roused me as a man who is awakened from his sleep. He said to me, "What do you see?" And I said, "I see and behold a lampstand, all of gold with its bowl on the top of it, and its 7 lamps on it with 7 spouts belonging to each of the lamps which are on top of it. Also 2 olive trees by it, one on the right side of the bowl and the other on the left side." Then I said to the angel who was speaking with me, saying, "What are these, my lord?" That's such a good question. What are these? And so he goes on, and he says, so the angel who was speaking with me answered and said to me, "Do you not know what these are?" And I said, "No, my lord." Then he said to me, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, saying," and then he gives this, "not by my might nor by my power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. What are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, you will become a plain, and he will bring forth the top stone with shouts of grace to it." So here he goes into a prophetic word, but he sets it up with this lamp and the 7 candles and the trees. And, okay, you know, you're sitting there going, okay. And what's hard for us is we're trying to picture this stuff in our brains, right? And we get all sorts of images. And it's just like, oh, geez, that's tough. Look over at chapter 5. This is great. I love this one. Zechariah 5. "Then I lifted up my eyes again, and I looked, and behold, there was a flying scroll." Okay, all right, wait a minute. Here we go. We got lampstands, we got flying scrolls. This is getting crazy. I mean, somebody ate a bad mushroom somewhere. "And he said to me, 'What do you see?'" And I love that. Isn't that great? Isn't that a great question? Don't you love these conversations with the angel? "And what do you see?" And you can imagine Zechariah. Do I tell him that I see a flying scroll, or do I tell him I see something else? You know, I got to be honest. I'm seeing a flying scroll. Am I close? You know, that's the way I would have been. I'd have been like, "Okay, God, I see a flying scroll. Am I right? God goes, "Yes." Okay. You know, because you're asking me, and I'm not real sure what I'm seeing here. So this is where I go crazy. But he says, "I see a flying scroll. Its length is 20 cubits, and its width 10 cubits. Then he said to me, 'This is the curse that is going forth over the face of the whole land. Surely everyone who steals will be purged away according to the writing on one side, and everyone who swears will be purged away according to the writing on the other side.'" Whoa, yeah, here we go, okay? So, again, a lot of symbolism, a lot of stuff out there, visions, lampstands, horses, flying scrolls, all sorts of visions are part of this. Now, again, it is difficult for us sometimes when we look at those things to really grasp and understand necessarily what God was trying to get across. But there is explanation given in the sense of that this is really the purpose of it, and the purpose is to convey this message, okay? That's what these things usually do. He also himself, Zechariah, did some symbolic demonstrations. Again, if you go back to some of the other prophets, remember we had prophets who would lay on their side for so long, for so many days, over a year. Others who would, you know, lay on their others, you know, all these different symbolic things. They were faced with symbolic things, going to the potter's house to see the potter. He worked the wheel and destroyed the you know, what he started to make, and then rebuilt it, and then God said, you know, that the clay is in the potter's hand, so are you. And so you have all this as part of it. This is the point I'm trying to get at, is that as minor a prophet as he was, there's a lot of vision stuff going on with him. Some of the stuff and some of these visions and some of these things that he shows us have this purpose of giving them a glimpse of reality in this post-exilic, again, after the exile, community they're living in, from a heavenly standpoint. Let me try to put that in other language, other words here. He's wanting them to understand what God is looking and seeing that they can be, and says to them, this is what you can become. Now strive for it. In other words, try to look through the eyes of God. Which, that's a challenge. If you haven't tried that before, please try that. Go ahead and ask God to give, as the song said, give me your eyes for just, you know, 1 minute. I'll tell you right now, I was reading some stuff on that song, and I came to the conclusion that I'm almost scared to do that. Because if I am given God's eyes for just one moment, or his ears for that moment, I'm going to see things that I will never, ever want to see again. I will hear things that I never knew were out there. You remember the movie, huh? Yes, Bruce Almighty. You knew where I was going. I love the movie Bruce Almighty, and I loved it simply for this reason. Because at night, when he tried to go to sleep, and all he could do is hear all the prayers of people all around the world praying to God. I know people get all upset about that movie. It's sacrilege. I tell you what, I thought it had a great point. I really did. I thought it did a good job. And I thought it was great because that scene was very poignant. Because he lays down to take his little rest and go to sleep that night, and he can't because he hears all these voices pleading, asking. And he's like, how does he do this? That's a good question. How does he do this? Since he's God and he can't. You're not. So that's one of the interesting things that we think about as we talk about this, is that God looks at, wants these people to have just a moment where they can see it from heaven's standpoint of what they can be and what they can become. You know, what all can you accomplish? What all can you do? He also is, the purpose of Zechariah is also to demonstrate that the Lord will establish his kingdom not through a gradual evolutionary process, but through struggle and tension. Here's what I mean by that. Yeah, this is a good one here. Let me break this one down. Basically, what we're saying here is that he's saying that God's not just going to let this thing, it's not just going to get started, and it's going to become something else, and become something else, and become something else, and become something else, until it gets to what it's supposed to be. What he's saying is it's going to do this. That the problem with this, of trying to establish his kingdom, here's the big problem. Human beings are involved. So, what human beings bring to the picture are those two things, struggle and tension. Struggling to figure out how we do what God calls us to do and how we accomplish that task. And the tension that we face as we have that tension in our lives between knowing what we should do and then what we end up doing. Right? Paul said it better than anybody. Those things that I should not do, I do. Those things that I should, I just don't do them. Even the things I should do, I don't do them. The things I should do, I do those. That's the tension we find ourselves in. And so, as human beings being part of God's plan, it's not just an evolutionary, you know, one thing gets better every time process. It is a process of struggle and tension in our lives. That's what causes growth. That's what causes spiritual growth in your life, is that struggle and that tension. If you don't have that struggle and tension, then I'm going to be concerned for you. I'm not being facetious or mean, I'm being serious. If you're not experiencing at some point in your walk, your daily walk, a struggle and tension, then you really got to evaluate some things of where you may be. Now, does that mean that I won't go through periods of my time in my life where things are just going to fall in place and it's going to be great? Sure, you will. But just know that as great as those moments are, you're going to face moments that are so dark and so difficult and so hard to go through that you will look back and wish for those days where things fell into place and went so nicely because because it's just like killing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in many cases, yeah. But you know what? In many cases, too, it's going to kick your butt. And that's how... Y'all, I'm having the most fun right now with Leah. She's getting ready for this marriage thing. It's just been a blast because she's suddenly having to realize some stuff, and it's just the best. It is so good. The other day, she got to talking about, what they had a mess up on the little apartment that Dylan's staying in Gainesville that we moved him into. There was a mess up on when the rent was exactly due, and they've got this late notice, and they thought they weren't late, and of course, he's a money tight freak, and he just went ballistic trying to go, what did I do wrong? And I gotta pay the rent. Of course, Leah's like, ah, it's okay, it's fine. And she's going, no, we gotta get fixed. It's just so fun. Because I'm sitting back going, that's aggravating, isn't it? It is. This is killing. Welcome to the world of adulting. Okay? This is what happened. So I get a call from her today. Oh my gosh, it was hilarious. She goes, Daddy. What, Lee? Hey, what? She goes, Dylan's car is all torn up again. I think the starter's gone on. It's what he thinks. What's that going to cost? I said, well, maybe probably a starter for that car anywhere from 50 to 60 bucks. Part of that's what they call the core. You're going to have to take the old one back and get 10, 12 bucks back. I said, if you do it, but you're going to have somebody probably have to do it on that car. And she goes, oh, I know. Well, who do we take it to? Well, I'd recommend my guy. I said, how about let me try to call him and tell him who you are. Maybe he'll cut you a little bit of break on the labor. He'll help you out. He's a good guy. He'll help you. Okay, because I just don't know how we're going to afford this. And of course, I'm just sitting there going, this is so funny. This is just so great. Because she is just, it's killing her. Sitting there going, welcome. You're finally there. Because up until this point, it was all, well, great, I got my paycheck. Well, it's gone. Well, Mom and Dad have got that. Great, yeah, I keep thinking that. And what's funny is she's trying to really be that adult. And so, like, Monday and Tuesday, when we were in St. Augustine, we told her, come over. You got Monday off. Come on over and spend some time with us. And so she did. Well, she came over there, and because they had to pay the rent, they're a little low in the old checking account. And so we told her, come on over. We'll take care of you. No problem. And, we were fixing to go somewhere, and she said, I don't have any gas in my car. I said, and you got how much in the bank? $20? I said, okay. I said, here you go, baby. Take my car, go right up here from the hotel, fill it up. I don't want to do that. I said, well, where are you going to go with no gas? I don't want to. Take the card and go fill up the tank. Okay. And so she does, and we bought her this little Honda Insight Hybrid. I mean, it took all $22 to fill the tank up. You think it's 40 miles to the gallon. And so I said, it's okay, sweetheart. Let us help you when we can. I said, I'm not going to do this all the time, but I said, it's what we do. And so it's just been one of the things of growing up. And so, for us, I think it's this thing where we go through those challenges, and we all have had our challenges. We've all been there and gone through that. Things like after my wife and I got married, and after our first night away, she woke up and she realized I was still there. I wasn't leaving. So, kind of ruined it for her, but are you still here, Mom? What do I do? All right, well, let's jump to the book of Malachi. We got to run through him real quick here. Her funny story about that, though, really, the funniest thing she tells about one of our first nights was that that place we stayed was a king size bed, and she'd gotten herself settled, and I was settled. Well, she kept moving because she didn't really want to be touching anybody. Not even me. And she kept sliding. Well, I kept following, apparently. And so she told my mother when we had gotten back down, she said, he followed me across that bed. And my mother said, well, you know what you should have done? And she said, what? She said, you should have gotten out of the bed, walked around to the other side, and got in on that side, and he'd have to follow you back that way. So, but we're both at that point in our lives now, though, where we get in the bed and go, don't touch me. Leave me alone. I got to go to sleep. He's like, you stay over there. And what's even better is we got a queen-size bed now because our room's really small, so it's terrible. We have to touch each other. There's just nothing there. No room. Oh, my God. Book of Malachi. Last book in the Old Testament. Now, again, these are not, you know, it's not chronological or anything. This is just kind of how they put it together and where they decided they'd end up. Malachi is an interesting name. It means messenger of Yahweh. So our other one was Yahweh, remember? This is messenger of Yahweh. The author is considered to be Malachi. And what's interesting is we really don't know anything about this guy. He's not really mentioned anywhere else. He's not talked about by anybody else. He's just kind of this prophetic blip on the radar. He's out there. Malachi. Ooh, okay. Nobody really knows him. And we don't. We do know that he was a prophet. That he was sent to the Jews who had resettled again in Judea. So we're talking about the same time period, roughly, as Zechariah, this post-exilic group that had gathered back in Judea. And so he's there and been sent to them. And again, like I told you, that's where you're going to find, if you start paying attention. If you could put all this stuff up on a big board and kind of put dates into a timeline, you'd discover how many of these prophets, it's their layer, okay? That they are all, they're there. Some of them are there at the same exact time. Some of them are picking them right before one leaves off. And it's, again, nobody's in a vacuum here. Nobody's by themselves. Basically, what's happening with Malachi and his message is this. Now, we went from uplifting and cheery and encouraging to this, where God says to Malachi, this is what I want to make sure you help them understand, that I'm not going to put up with their sin forever. There's going to come a time where I've had enough. And there's going to be a point at which there will be a day of judgment. That's what this leads to. That there will come a time where God will say history needs to end and judgment needs to occur. Okay? And this is what he's talking about here, and this was the message. He also explains this, though, and this is the other side of the thing. He explains and tells Malachi to make sure they understand that he's not going to hold on to this wrath and this anger if the people return to him. Where have we heard this before? It almost sounds like a broken record in some cases, but it is the potential change. It is the same message that is given all through these prophetic books that, again, God says, there's going to come a point of judgment if you guys keep doing this, but if you come back to me and do what I ask you to do and be the people that you're supposed to be for me, then I my wrath will not be upon you. I could love you again, and I can care for you, and I can bless you, and everything's right in the world. Okay? And so that's the same thing we start off with this book. One of the things that's interesting about the Jews, when they came back from this exile in Babylon and they got back to Judea, one of the things that they were very, very careful about was they wanted to guard against any pagan idol worship. They were very focused on not doing that. Okay, now that's when they first get back. And we know how things go, right? But they were there. But here's what eventually happens. They get to a point that they give up on this because to give up on this, I think, like we all do in a lot of ways sometimes where we struggle, and I'm going to speak for myself here, that there come moments and things and challenges that we go through. And sometimes, as human beings, we become very short-sighted, and we become frustrated, and we get through one thing, and we see God's hand in it and go, okay, God, I see that. And we get nailed with another thing. And we go, really, God? This is happening again. You know, I just got past this. I just got through this. And something else occurs. And something else happens. And we're like, here we go again. And we get frustrated. And sometimes we fall into bad habits, old habits, things that brought us comfort at one point in our time in life, which weren't necessarily the best things to be giving us comfort, right? And we fall into those traps. Well, Israel is falling into the same trap. The Hebrews are doing the same thing. And they eventually give up on this idea of no idol worship because it's so hard. You have to work so hard to do this stuff. You got to make an effort to love God. You got to make an effort to be in relationship with Him. Go fancy that. Yeah, you've got to make an effort. You've got to do those things to desire that relationship so that God knows and feels and understands that you desire that relationship. And then, here's the funny thing about that. He can meet you, and He can give you the desires of your heart. Did you hear what I just did there? I hope you followed me on that. You desire this right relationship. You desire to do the things God wants you to do. And what does God and what does Scripture tell us that God will do and give us? The desires of our heart. So if my heart is desiring a right relationship with God, if my heart is desiring to be right with Him, if my heart is desiring to do what His will is and His will alone, then God can look at that and say, well, then I can grant you the desires of your heart because those are the right things. Now, if my desire is something else based on a worldly accomplishment, God's going to look at that and say, but that's not the true desire that I want you to have, and it's not really a good desire of the heart. That's a desire of lust. That's a desire of your mind. That's a desire of the world. I want you to have the desire of your heart to do these things, and I can give you that. Just an interesting one. Malachi basically was sent there to instruct them, to give them some guidance on how to have a more pure life. What is it we need to do? That's what the Jews were trying to figure out. What do we need to do? Malachi was sent there to do this. He pointed out a lot of this. He said, here's some of your problems. He says, first of all, you're not giving. You're not tithing. You're not doing what God asks you to do. You're not giving back to Him that a portion of that which He's blessed you with. You've forgotten how to do that. He then says, here's the other problem. Here's some more things that are happening. Divorce has become commonplace. Okay, now let us understand what he's saying here. It's become commonplace. In other words, no longer is necessarily divorce occurring because there is a bad situation that's getting worse and worse and worse, or something that's happened, or unfaithfulness. It has just simply become commonplace. It is just very easy to do. Huh? Yeah, you're tired of it. You just don't want to make the effort, so you decide, I'm done with her, or she's done with you. That's that. Exactly. Then there was this other thing. These mixed marriages. And that was marriages of God's people with pagans. And these folks who weren't of God's people at the time and had not made that decision yet to be one of God in the sense of following Him. And so you had this clash of two worlds. And trust me, there's some problems there. I know we live in this world of plurality. We live in a world where, you know, everybody's okay. You know, I'm okay, you're okay, everyone's okay. Everything else is okay. I hate to sound like, you know, an old curmudgeon here, but it's not the case all the time. It's not always the case. It was fascinating to me. I started reading this article. I just kind of glanced through it, but it was interesting. It had to do with a celebrity. It had to do with Janet Jackson. Did anybody see this? Janet Jackson, she's my age, she's 50, just had her first child not too long ago. She married this guy, he was from Qatar, which is a Middle East country, old country. Married this Qatarian prince, married him, had a child with him, and not too long after the child was born, their marriage went. And what was said over and over again in the article in the little subheadings was that their cultures were just too drastically different and their views were too different. Well, duh! You got a girl that grew up in a family from Detroit doing R&B music, living in the U.S., used to the money, used to the fame, used to places like Vegas and everywhere else, even when she was a little old kid. You got a Qatarian prince who just was given everything he's ever wanted, and he doesn't work for his money. He just gets it because of his family lineage. She's worked hard all her life to have what she has. And you married the guy thinking, oh, we're going to be okay. Here's your sign. You're stupid. You know, I'm sorry. What do you expect to have happen? Well, again, with God's people, it's kind of the same thing he's saying here. Okay, wait a minute. Joe Bob Fred, you're going to go marry this gal, and she doesn't even know your tradition. She doesn't know what it means to be a child of the Jewish people and to be God's chosen people. She doesn't grasp it. And you just think she's just gorgeous and the nicest thing you've ever met, and she dances real good, so you're going to go marry her? Well, what point is she going to wake up and go, you know what, I don't like this stuff. And what point are you going to wake up and go, she just doesn't know anything about me. Well, duh. Golly, people. Use the brain God gave you. And so this was a problem going on in Israel. And so God really got to a point he was dealing with it, and that's why he sent Malachi in there, And he began to basically start taking away the physical rewards they had gotten, the things they had, the prosperity, their position, their influence. He started taking that away from the people because he just refused to listen. Okay? Another thing that God dealt with in Malachi, through Malachi, he rebuked the priests because the priests had lost their way. Okay? The priests were not doing what they were supposed to be doing. They weren't leading in worship correctly. They weren't doing the things and keeping things holy as they should. These guys had lost it. And they weren't doing as God had instructed. And so he rebuked them and said, these guys are not doing what they're supposed to do. Their job, again, is to point out and point to me as the living God, the only living God, and the relationship I have. And they're to help us, help them understand that, and to work, help them worship and to understand the sacrifices they make. But they're not doing their job. So he warned him. He said, look, it's going to come this day of judgment, and it's going to be swift. It's going to involve destruction, all because you disobeyed the law that I gave you. Again, we've heard this before. Because, again, the bottom line with this stuff is God's desire through all of this is that his people continually seek him out and be in relationship with him. Now, again, being New Testament Christians, we have the advantage of this thing called grace. We really do. This thing called grace, this understanding of it. Because God's desire, again, is for us to be in relationship with him on a continual basis. And if there was no grace for me, then I would really struggle to be in relationship at all with him. Okay? Because, again, I'm just absolutely so fallible. I went by Kentucky Fried Chicken this evening to get some food for the boys and myself. And I'm at that point, I've taught long enough now in Putnam County that some of my first kids are now high schoolers. They're getting, you know, they're moving on to graduation and all this stuff. I got two of them that work over here at the KFC, a guy and a gal that I taught at Jenkins. And so I pull up and I see he sees me. He goes, well, hey, Mr. Carpenter. I'm like, hey, Robbie, what's up? And he said, nothing much. He said, and so and the other little girl's behind that I taught, she goes, well, he said, you still teaching, right? I said, yeah, over at Price now. He said, do those kids better than us? I'm like, yeah, I like the Price kids. They're a little better than you Jenkins kids. Give them a hard time. He said, oh, he said, she goes, she, and the gold girl said, well, we were great. I said, actually, I said, you guys were a pretty good class. And then all of a sudden, she goes, yeah, she said, I remember that day that you took that marker and you pulled the top off and you threw it across the room. I said, oh, you remember the day I threw that marker across the room? And she goes, yeah, it was kind of funny. I said, yeah, it was, wasn't it? I said, y'all were making me mad. You know that? She goes, yeah. She goes, she said, it kind of got, it shook us up. I said, did I get your attention? She goes, yeah. I said, well, that's what I was trying to do. So anyway, so, you know, I don't know how great that is that her memory's going to be that I threw a marker across the room, but, you know, that's okay. So, you know, I'll live with that, I guess. Yes, you remembered it, so, you know, I am memorable. So God had this desire for his people to be in relationship with him. Israel, again, one of the other things that we got to remember here too, guys, and if you notice that next one, I think this is kind of important. Well, it is important. It's not kind of important. God got frustrated with Israel too for this other fact. Not only were they not doing what he was asking them to do to be in relationship with him, but they were also failing at their other calling, which was what? To be a light unto the nations. They weren't doing that. Because of their lack of relationship with him, they weren't being useful and being a light to the other nations, for the other nations to look at and say, we need this relationship with this God. This God must be real. Because look at what God does for them when they are loving him and being, you know, in relationship with him. God blesses them. God takes care. He protects them. You know, they weren't doing that. People weren't looking at it and going, yeah, I want some of that. I mean, and again, let's put it where we are today. Isn't that one of the biggest struggles? That a lot of people look at us as Christians, and unless, you know, sometimes they'll look at it, and unfortunately, a lot of them are going to look at it and go, yeah, I want some of what he's got. Yeah, I want that. Sometimes they look at us and go, what's wrong with him? You know, what's wrong with her? I thought they went to church. I thought they were Christians. Yeah, but I'm human too, but you can understand. Yeah, I'm having a really bad day today, but you know, God's grace is going to get a hold of me at this point. I'm going to be okay tomorrow. I'm going to be okay tonight. And it's going to be all right. And that's where we have to communicate. But Israel wasn't doing that very well. You see, God had a purpose for his people. And he wanted them to understand that he loved them, he cared for them, but he needed their respect. He needed them to honor him. That was part of what he needed. He needed their faithfulness. The interesting thing, as I said, Malachi is not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible, but he deals with some of the same issues that Ezra and Nehemiah dealt with right prior to him. Again, he talks about corrupt priests, intermarriage with pagans, lapses in tithing and offerings, all that's part of it. The Jews basically, again, had a hard time recognizing God's love for them. You know, that we do this out of love. Isn't that the challenge sometimes in our lives and in relationships? And when we decide to do something, it may seem harsh. Sometimes we do it because we know it's the most loving thing that we can do for them. And sometimes it comes off as harsh, and they look at that and they go, I don't see that as very loving. But yet we know that it's the most loving thing we can do. Because, you know, sometimes the most loving thing you can do for some people is to simply say, enough's enough. Okay? You do that with your kids, right? If you love your children, you're going to reach a point where you say, enough's enough. You can't do this anymore. You cannot continue to make this choice because you're damaging you and you're hurting me and you're hurting, you know, everybody in your family. Enough's enough. When I was in seminary, I'm glad I get to tell this story. I didn't even plan this. God told me to tell this story. When I was in seminary, I had a class in pastoral care, pastoral counseling. What? You shut up. Nobody asked you. You hadn't heard this one. And I knew you hadn't heard this one. So, hey, with friends like him, I don't need enemies. But pastoral care class, the guy that taught the class was this guy. He was about 6'5". He was a really big, tall guy. Had a big, bushy mustache. Very intimidating guy when you looked at him. Very quiet, very sincere. And he was telling us one night, he said, guys, he said, the challenge to counseling families, he said, it's multifaceted. You have to really be able to pick up on things. He said, one day, he said, I'd gotten a call from somebody, said, I've got a family that needs to come see you because they've got a 16-year-old son who is physically abusing the entire family. This kid was beating up everybody in the family, parents and kids. And he said, that's fine. So, you know, I'll be glad to see him. So they all came in mass to his office, the whole group, the whole family, and they came to his office. He invited them all in, and he had them sit in specific spaces, and he had the 16-year-old sit close to his desk. He said, I want you right here. The kid sat down there and kind of trying to bow up and do what he was, but he sat down there. And everybody else sat around here. And then he said, what I did was, he said, for the next 5-6 minutes, he said, I sat behind my desk, and he said, I just crossed my arms, and he said, and I looked at that 16-year-old boy, and I just stared at him right in the face, in the eye, for about 6 minutes. Of course, by this time, the kid's getting really nervy. He's starting to fidget, trying to figure out what he's doing. And then the doctor says, I leaned over to him, and I said, hey, do you think you can take me? Do you think you can better me? And of course, 16-year-old who'd been beating up his family, he said, sure I can. He said, okay. He said, but I want to warn you about something. He said, I don't fight fair. And the kid looked at him, well, what do you mean? He said, Francis, look right here on my desk. He said, do you see this thing? And he had one of those really nice pointy things where he'd take memos and notes and he'd put them on there and, you know, pierce them. He said, you see that right there? The kid said, yeah. He said, I promise you, you come across that desk to me, he said, I'm going to pick that up and I'm going to hit you with it and I'm going to stab you with it. The kid looked at him, what do you mean? Because I told you I don't fight fair. He said, and guess what we're going to learn today? Your family is here today, and I'm going to teach them how to not fight fair anymore with you. Your days of bullying your family, beating up your family, are done. And we're going to learn how to not fight fair anymore, and we're going to take care of that problem. Blew this kid's mind. He didn't know what to do, but it worked. Now, that's an amazing guy. This guy's just brilliant. I mean, I never thought of that. But it's an amazing thing. He was able to do that, and he was able to say, look, enough's enough. Here's the most loving thing I'm going to do for you today, and that is I'm going to teach you that I'm going to tell your family this is how we don't fight fair anymore. So if he comes at you, you call the cops right away and you get him arrested next to you. If he comes at you again and he's physically abusing you, you reach for whatever's within distance and you get it and you protect yourself. That's if you have to physically protect yourself. Do what you have to do to bring this to a halt. loving thing that God does to us can be very harsh, or harsh for what we think is harsh. But it's actually the most loving thing God can do for us, to take away something, or to put us in a situation that we've dreaded all our life. Why? Because we need that. Because we've got to understand something about us and who God is. Again, their problem is, as we've talked about, they were just becoming indifferent, very callous. They had this spirit of confrontation, argumentation. They just wanted to argue all the time. They wanted to confront everything all the time. And what he said was this. He said, "For those of you who do respond and come back to me, your name will be placed in a book of remembrance." Now, doesn't that sound interesting? Sounds like something we'd experience later in the book of Revelation, right? The Lamb's Book of Life. "You'll be placed in the book of remembrance, and I will consider you as one of my jewels." That's beautiful. In other words, I will consider you to be of just immense value. Now, isn't that another thing that we as human beings like to have? We like to know that we matter. There are very few human beings out there that you can look at and can honestly look in the eye and say, "Well, I don't care if I matter." No, you do care. You do care. Yet it is something important. You matter to someone. These people, eventually, as they turned to God, they feared the Lord, spoke to one another, they talked about fellowship, they meditated on His Word and His name. They began to get rid of all this despair. They went and found hope. They got rid of the error and they found truth. They began to serve Him. And they had this willingness to obey God and seek His kingdom. This was what God was wanting from them, and this is what they finally came to understand. So, even in Malachi, we have this very positive picture painted in the end, that they finally figured it out. And once they figured it out, they began God's blessing. I often, especially with books like this, and I know we're over time, just give me 2 seconds, 2 minutes, 2 seconds, that when you look at this, a lot of this can be compared again to the church and who we are as believers. Because the struggle within churches is so often, and this is the reality of why a lot of churches close these days, and it's a sad thing. In fact, let me tell you, it just hit home while I was up with my parents. It's a beautiful church. It's right about, I don't know, it's maybe 5-6 miles from where my parents live, suburbs of Atlanta, Gainesville, Georgia. Chestnut Mountain Baptist Church. At one point, they had 1,500 people come to that church. Had this beautiful new facility they built. Absolutely gorgeous place. Dynamic church, doing stuff, making a difference, impacting their community for Christ. Had some stuff happen. Had a pastor come in there and caused a split and took half up with him. They had another guy come in. The church started building back up, got back up to about 1,500 people coming regularly. And then suddenly things changed. Something went wrong somewhere. And now they're barely running 300 people. And the other day, while I was up there, my brother-in-law had found out that they were done. They were belly up. They had no more money. They were broke. And the church was going to close its doors. Heartbreak. Very heartbreak. I don't know the specifics, but I can generally tell you what happened. People forgot why they were here. People forgot what their calling was. People forgot what they needed to do. They were more interested probably in trying to find themselves entertained, or trying to find something that felt good to them, or something that fit into where they were and what they thought. They were not interested in being challenged. They weren't interested in being convicted. They weren't interested in having God work in their lives in powerful ways so that He made things happen and they had to make decisions about things. Maybe they forgot that they had to reach out into that community and go get the people. That the people just aren't going to show up at the doorstep. Trust me, they're not going to. Not today. We're past that point. Same thing here. God is looking to His nation to say to them, "Guys, you need to be the light. These people are not just going to come crawling up to me and just saying, 'Well, I know this and that, and I want to find God in this.' Sure, that may happen to some, most of these people need somebody to be their light. Most of these people need somebody to guide them and direct them in that way, to say, this is what you need to do. This is what I know about relationship with God. You know, I can't give the perfect answer to every question I face. But what I can do is I can tell you what I know. I can tell you what I've experienced. I can tell you what it's done for me. I can tell you what faith means to me. I can tell you how important grace and mercy is to me. I can't tell you how important it is to Patrick. I got no idea. God knows he needs it, but I have no idea. I can't do that for anybody else. But if somebody has questions, I can try to be that glimmer of light to say, this is what I do. That when you're talking to somebody about faith and they ask a question that you can't necessarily answer, did you know that it's absolutely wonderfully okay to say, I don't know. I'm not sure. People need folks to be honest, not to give them pretentious, silly answers. They need you to be able to say, you know what, I really don't know. Every person is going to appreciate that more than you think.
Well, according to...
Exactly. All right, guys, any questions? But I know we got to go. Yes, sir. You know, that's when I heard that, I was just like, about that church up there, I think that's the sad thing. I hope somebody comes along, because right now that's the same situation. They got a bank that's going to jump on that property, and that prime property right there, there's right behind them sits a subdivision of $300,000 houses. So if they got this property, somebody's going to jump on that heartbeat, tear all that stuff down, start building houses. I guarantee you. All right, guys, say a prayer and we need to go. Heavenly Father, again, thank you for what you've helped us to see tonight. We thank you, God, again, for your word.